Well, I'd like to welcome you all to the Australian Institute of International Affairs, Victoria. I'm Tim Healy, the Vice President, and it's a great pleasure to have you all here today. We're particularly pleased to have a whole lot of girls from Lauriston, so I hope you enjoy and find this an interesting and profitable session. I'm sure you will. We have one new member here. He has been a week or so ago, but it wasn't acknowledged. Anthony Ware. Anthony, where about you? Welcome, formally, as a new member. We're pleased to have you here. Microfinance, the answer to poverty and women's empowerment. I think quite a few of us think we know a little bit about this, but when I began to think about it, I realised it was pretty superficial, my knowledge. So we're very pleased to have tonight Ms. K.C. Ranjani, who's the India Director of Opportunity International Australia, to talk to us on microfinance. We're very pleased to have her in her own right because she's extremely experienced in her own field, having been in banking and development and a development specialist for over 20 years. And she's a director of Social Microfinance for Opportunity International and has been a board member of a number of leading microfinance institutions in India. And also, we're very pleased to welcome her today because it's International Women's Day today, and so it's doubly a good thing to have you here today. We also have, and they're going to do, I don't know whether I'd describe it as a Punch and Judy show or a Punch and Judy show. We've got Robert Dunn, who's the CEO of Opportunity Australia, International in Australia. So I will await to see how this develops, this dual welcome and over to you.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you, Tim. And thanks for having us. It's great to be with you today. Microfinance, Ranjani, often in the news.
Yeah.
Let's explore it a little bit. What is microfinance?
Yeah, many people understand microfinance as giving out small loans and collecting it back and revolving it all over again. But I want to tell you that microfinance is much more than that. It is the beginning of an empowerment process for the women and for the families involved. And it may start with a small loan, but then we can always use that as a strong, robust distribution platform for various social goods, starting from social savings, pensions, micro insurance, and then community health, preventive health, and going on to livelihoods. And so that's the beginning of a journey for a whole lot of people who never had access to resources to begin with.
Why don't these people just go to the bank and get a bank loan?
Yeah.
Or open a savings account or something like that?
Because most of our people whom we work with, they live in developing countries. And I'm particularly talking today about India. In India, 60% of our people don't have access to banking services. They don't even have a bank account.
And of course, when people don't have bank accounts and they save, what happens?
Yeah, you can just imagine that in a slum, when people women try to save, they try and hide it somewhere or the other. And then it could be stolen by anyone in the family, in the neighborhood, it just lost.
So microfinance, as you say, is often thought of as microcredit.
Yeah, small, but it's loans. Much beyond that.
Yeah, okay. Talk about the loans. How small is a small loan?
A small loan could be as small as $100. Or it could be $200. That's enough in that context to start a small income generation activity. It's as small as that.
And how long does it take to pay off $100?
usually in India, usually it's a weekly repayment or a monthly repayment. Why is it in why is it so done so frequently? Because microfinance institutions like to capture the surpluses in the family, in the ladies' hands as fast as possible and make the repayments. Otherwise, it will be lost somewhere or it will be used up for some other emergency that always happens in poor families. So it's a way of, you know, getting the woman to focus on the income generation activity, make surpluses and get it back, repay the loan off so that she's not indebted.
And for how long does the loan last?
It usually lasts, they say it's usually a 50 weeks repayment. That means it's paid off within a year.
So you can borrow $100 and sometimes even lower than $100.
Sure.
And have to pay it off in weekly installments over the whole of the year.
Yeah, that's
what we're talking about, very small amounts of money.
Very tiny amounts of money.
Does this work?
It works.
I know it works too.
In India, actually, our program is working with 1.2 million families. And it works. It has worked every time. The repayment rate is 97% to 98%. On-time repayment, because the women really value the resources they are getting access to for the first time in their lives, and they like to repay it on time.
Okay, now you keep talking about women. Does everyone who borrow a microfinance loan or is a client of microfinance a woman?
In India especially, 94% are women, and mainly because they are the ones who are deprived of resources. You know, the whole world over, only 1% of women own any assets. And of the whole lot of poor people in the world, 60% are women. So that's why the focus on women.
I think you mean 1% of the assets are owned by women.
Yeah, that's
it. As opposed to 1% of women own the assets.
Oh, sorry.
1% of the assets are owned by women.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right. That's okay. We've been doing this all week. Okay.
Sorry about that.
So, no, that's fine. That's good. Okay, so you talked about 90, the vast majority of the clients are women, and they're making these repayments. How does it work? How does a microfinance repayment work?
Yeah, if you look at this slide, this is Madhu, and she is in the slums in Gujarat, Ahmedabad, and she has a husband and a girl child. The husband was very, very sick, and she is illiterate, and she was unemployed. And one of our microfinance institution, MFI partner in Gujarat, Prayas, they were working in those slums, found her and offered to help her out with a loan. It was $150 loan, and she didn't know anything. She didn't have any serious skills. So what she did was she knew that she can go buy some fruits and sell it. That's exactly what she did. And then with the next loan, she would have bought that cart, and she used that income to give medical help to her husband. Now currently he is fully healed. He had serious problems, and now the husband helps her with this business, and she's planning to send her child for, you know, to give her education as much as possible. She doesn't want her child to go through the trauma and the problems that she had, because she was illiterate, she didn't have any access, she didn't have resources, she was married off, all those social issues that come with not having resources. And so it's a beginning of a generation change. It is a beginning of a generation change. Madhu's daughter will not be like Madhu. She will not face the issues that Madhu faced.
We see that time and time again when we talk to these ladies about their hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
Almost invariably, they talk about their children and their education.
Sure.
And they'll do anything to get their sons educated, won't they?
But the women who get access to resources, when we go to the field, they'll say, we will send our daughters also to school. If there wasn't enough resource, if it was rationed out, then the son would get a preference. So it's a gender play, but if there is enough resource, then the girl would definitely go to school. We'll have a question and answer session.
I just wondered, will they have to pay for her education, or is it free?
It depends. Usually, there are free schools, but the quality of education is not that good in government schools, so they would send her to a different kind of school which offers a little more better quality of education, but for that they have to pay.
Yeah.
But she would earn enough to pay for that.
School where the teachers turn up.
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay.
How are you? In your schools, do the teachers come all the time?
People are probably paying some fees.
Okay.
And you talked about her daughter, if she gets educated, may not marry off so young.
No, she. I think she will have her own mind, looks like.
I mean, the average age girls get married in India is...
It's just got
out of the 15s and is now 16.
But 18 is, yeah, but 18 is the legal, legally permitted age to marry.
And that's the average.
No, 18.
18, yeah. 18,
yeah.
But 16 is the average. Last year it got up to 16. It's increasing. So we see a great difference in microfinance clients.
Yeah.
And educated women, educating a girl is the best thing you can do.
Yeah, that's the most attractive thing about microfinance. You say microfinance is all about loans. No, it's about education, it's about health, it's about generations, helping generations out of
Now, one of the things that's interesting about microfinance is that the repayment rates are so high, and mm-hmm. given that Madhu has no credit history, has no assets,
yeah.
and she's borrowing, somebody's lent her money, and the repayment rates are 97-98%, which means that the money keeps, because the institutions make about 3% profit at least, the money is...
Recycled.
It's sustainable,
yeah.
Right? It just recycles. How come it's so high? Why are the repayment rates so high?
Because I think for a person like Madhu, this is the first time she would have had any access to any institutional financial service, even though it is a microfinance institution. And maybe this is the first time she would have learned to sign her sign off on documents. And so it is actually giving her a social collateral, a formal track record of taking a loan, repaying it on time, and she knows that if she repays it on time, the microfinance MFI would again give her the next loan, second loan. Maybe she could start another enterprise or improve her business. So it's a hope of keeping up, just like how we don't like to default on any of our credit cards. They wouldn't want to default on their loans. It's serious track record being built up.
And in addition, they work together as a group, don't they?
Sure. So they also mutually guarantee each other in a group. Usually microfinance transactions are done in a group mode. So Madhu will belong to a group where four more ladies of her social stature and economic background would be members. And they all take loans. And every week after week, the loan officer comes to collect the loans, repayments. But if there is one lady is in difficulty in 1 week, all of them would just pitch up and pay off that. And the next time, it would be their turn to, if somebody else is not able to. So they will make up for it. And that's how this whole social system works together. It's just not one person. It's a whole community coming together in groups and helping one another with whatever little social and economic collateral that they have, and they're building up.
Now, you work for Dear Vikas, which you're the managing director of Dear Vikas, which is Opportunities subsidiary company in India, and Dear Vikas does this microfinance work through partners,
yes.
Which I think you've already called MFIs or microfinance institutions, and we have 15 such partners.
Yes.
And together
they serve, I think I already mentioned that, 1.2 million families.
Okay.
So there are, and you multiply it by 5.5, a factor of 5.5, that's average family size in India. So that's the kind of number of people we are influencing.
So one of these partner organizations, MFIs,
yeah.
is, well, we have three in Orissa, which is quite a poor state in
yeah,
India.
Yeah, sure.
So we're going to talk a minute about commercial, profit-centered microfinance versus socially focused microfinance. It's a real issue, and it's an absolutely crucial distinction. We support socially focused microfinance. We're about opportunities, about helping people get themselves out of poverty. They do the getting. We do the helping. Mm-hmm. One of our partners in Orissa I visited one day, and I'm sure you've been
yeah.
to this group of women as well.
Yeah.
And It's the women live in a leper colony. It's quite separated from everything else. It's in a rural area. There are big signs up warning you that it's a leper colony. And this is where these women live. And they got a group loan, quite a different sort of loan. Instead of an individual loan, the whole of the group got a loan. And the MFI didn't just do the banking part, here's a loan. They taught them how to develop a livelihood, which is making rope out of coconut coir. They then brokered the relationships with the suppliers and the customers in the marketplace so these women could have a livelihood that worked despite their difficult position. And we loved that. We just thought that. And that took something like 2 years to pull off. I don't know how much money they lost in doing that transaction, but boy, when somebody says, does microfinance transform lives, I think of these ladies. This is a 90-second video clip. There's about a 6-minute version on our website if you look at our website and go to resources. So these are the rope weavers of Kerta. That's a story. There's zillions of stories like that. It's a special thing that we get to do, isn't it? Go and talk to people.
That's the most encouraging thing, and you know that's the best energizer I ever have. When you're a little challenged or depressed, go and talk to these clients, and they'll just boost you up your morale.
Microfinance has been around for a while.
Yeah, it was, of course, all of you know it is the father of microfinance, Mohammed Yunus. Professor Mohammed Yunus has won the Nobel Prize. But there's a gentleman in Australia, and I think, Rob, you are the best person to tell about David Basso.
Yeah, David Basso. He's actually a Kiwi, but like all good Kiwis, we adopt him. And he's the guy who started Opportunity International. At roughly the same time, in the 70s, and I've spoken to some of our partners' CEOs, and they've got the same story.
Yeah.
There's no business plan involved. They're not sitting down saying, you know what, I'm going to start a business. I'm going to start microfinance. It's not like that at all. Time and time again, I run into people whose stories, just like David's. He was in Indonesia. He's a builder. He's an entrepreneur. He's one of these incredibly entrepreneurial guys. And he was in Indonesia helping repair some buildings that were in Bali that were damaged by an earthquake in a village. So he took his family 14 kilometres from the nearest road, bought a supply, etc. Lived there for a year, helped rebuild these buildings. And one day his foreman said to him, my wife is pregnant, this will be the third generation of our family entrapped by loan sharks, money lenders. These are people who make loans but at really high rates of interest. And you can just never get out of the debt trap. So I'll give you an example. Money lenders in the Philippines are called 5/6s. Mm-hmm. You borrow 5 in the morning and you repay 6 at night. That's 20% interest a day. And it just accumulates. And if you can't make the payment, that's okay, it just accumulates. And so you can see how families just get entrapped and end up indenturing their children. It's just a nightmare. So David did what a number of our partners, CEOs have done, is just in enraged compassion said, here's the money, get out of that situation, let's now talk about how you're going to pay me back. And that was the start of microfinance. I think David invented microfinance. I think Mohammed Yunus invented microfinance. I think a number of people continue to do this. And at the time, he was quite criticised for making the poor pay back. But he saw that was an empowerment, a dignified thing. You know, it's not a handout. This is a transaction. We're equals here in this transaction. And the man had a wife who was good at sewing, and so David, being super entrepreneurial, set her up in a sewing business. And then he went about saying, how can I make this work? And so he's 70 now. He still spends at least half of each year in the back blocks of Indonesia or the Philippines. We've been going 38 years or something, Opportunity International, 40 years. There was an American guy he teamed up with who was a couple of years ahead of him. And we now work in 47 countries, and millions of families are the beneficiaries of that. And your own background, you're actually the mother of Indian microfinance. I know you hate this, but that's Ranjini. But you are. I mean, you started the Indian microfinance sector going, really, didn't you, or boosted it?
Actually, I was working in the Development Bank, Industrial Development Bank of India. They spun off a subsidiary called Small Industries Development Bank of India, and that was a time when microfinance was just being talked about across, you know, in Bangladesh and in the newspapers. We're just beginning to read, and we had this mandate from our from the current Prime Minister, who was then the Reserve Bank Governor, to start up a microfinance program in the bank, and that sort of found its way to my table. And from there, so that gave us a unique opportunity to create a new product in our bank, and that involved lending to institutions who would on lend to the poor, so two-tier lending. Bankers who know it's not very acceptable, but the bank as a special case allowed two-tier lending. Then lending without collaterals is unheard of in Indian banking sector in those days. It's about, you know, 2001. So we didn't know. We knew that to convince our credit committee, we had to have something to back up. So we created a whole lot of something called credit rating for the microfinance sector. We created an institution to do that, and then we knew that microfinance interest rate is high, but it is cheap. The women know that it's cheap compared to the loan sharks, but is high compared to the formal banking sector. So it's a question of access versus cost. And microfinance is midway. It gives better access. It's costlier than bank loans, but cheaper than shark loans, and so it provides the access. So these three key parameters, this was a policy change that the bank made, and it opened up the sector in India for the microfinance silent revolution that happened.
And it goes on, and we see it going on. And in a minute, I want to get to some of the problems that the success of Indian microfinance has caused. Because wherever you get lending and people borrowing, you're in danger of problems, as you know. But before we get to that, just one more story about what life is like for women, being International Women's Day.
Yeah.
Sunita, can you quickly tell us her story.
Sunita embodies all the challenges. When I look at her, I know that these are the challenges that 1.2 million families, women face. Lack of access to resources, illiteracy, lack of health services, lack of sanitation, health and sanitation, medical facilities. You can think of anything that you just go home and close your eyes and think of all this lacks. You're basically just it's just a basic existence, live or how long, or that kind of a very vulnerable situation. And the children, she's got 4 or 5 children, and married off at an young age, and they all sleep in just one room. They live in one room. Part of it is partitioned off to keep her the pigs that she bought with the microfinance loan. And on top of that slab, her children sleep. It's all, but still, she's a very courageous woman. And so this is, for me, is symbolic of many millions of people face in poverty.
So she ended up taking a loan, the pigs died, took a loan, the pigs were stolen, took a loan, the pigs reproduced. 3 loans, some piglets, and now she's a butcher, isn't she?
That is the enterprise. So the third loan, it just gave her a lot of money compared to her levels of thinking. And she leased out a land in the village, housed her pigs there. Next time when I went to see her, she had a small meat shop going. Enterprise at its best, coming resilience and overcoming challenges and difficulties.
Okay, now we've talked about how it works. One of the interesting things, we talked about the recycling, but we haven't talked about leverage.
Yeah, for example, I'll take our own example. Opportunity Australia collects donations in Australia, and it is downloaded as equity into the Indian entity. The Indian entity is known as Diya Vikas Capital. That is basically Opportunity India. Okay, so we receive it as equity capital, and then it is used to support microfinance partners across India. We work with 15 of them. Our money goes as equity or subordinated debt into those institutions, and they then, that enables them to borrow from their commercial banks in India. So if we give $1 million, it gets to the field as $4 or $5 million. That's a leverage story.
Subordinated debt is debt where you rank behind every other piece of debt.
It's a quasi equity.
You say I'll go last. If we can't repay any debt, let it be me.
Yeah.
So everybody else goes, cool, that's great. That helps me. That helps in the that helps them meet their risk targets.
The $31 million that have come from Australia has leveraged $161 million at the grassroots level, and that's the aggregate loan book that the Avica's partners carry today, reaching out to 1.2 million families.
Okay, so that all sounds great. What could go wrong?
Yeah, so when there's a good story, always there will always be a crisis to make it very interesting. So what has happened is the banking leverage and everything was going good, and the leverage became 2 times, 3 times, 5 times, 10 times, because everybody was doing so good and the repayment rate was 98%, and so it was a very good story, and that attracts what private equity capital into the scene, right? So some of the leading, the 2-3 leading MFIs in India received huge private equity, and then the focus was on getting the best returns for them. Not that all private equity is bad, I don't believe that, but in this particular space, it's not good. If you drive a business growth without being sensitive to the people you're serving, so it became a supply-led issue, and families started getting into over indebted positions, and then came coercive collection practices and client protection issues, and then that is where the politicians step in. Till then there was no regulation, then the regulation came in and it was very tough, and it almost killed the industry in that one particular province. So that was in March 2010, and the media was very active, and they said the microfinance industry is dead in India. But I want to tell you it's not dead, and the social microfinance people kept it going, and it has shrunk, but it's now, the worst is over.
So if you like, there are microfinance operators who are seeking to make as much money out of this as finance companies.
Yes.
And then there are socially focused microfinance players who are there to help people out of poverty.
Sure.
And we're that latter part?
Yeah, the latter part.
So we actually thought the crisis was a good thing as long as we lived, basically, because it would clean out the industry. But we were in danger of getting cleaned out ourselves.
No, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so the industry has hit the bottom, and now it's going moving up towards. The bankers are starting to re-engage, and we believe that microfinance sector will now grow more in a more healthy way with client protection practices in place, code of conduct, regulations. For example, the Reserve Bank, Central Bank of India has come out with very clear regulations, and we are and a microfinance regulatory bill is likely to be tabled in Parliament in March. If that that gets passed, then that would put this industry on a very strong platform.
Okay, so we just got about 2 minutes
okay.
No, that's okay. It's cool. But we started out by saying microfinance is a lot more than just loans.
Sure.
And on the slide, it said things like pensions and health and water and sanitation. It's sort of, I think the statistic that's one of the most challenging is 60% of people in India don't have a toilet in their own homes. And the only place they can go to a toilet is a community toilet, which is a very dangerous place to be, especially for children. But just about everyone's got a mobile phone or access to a mobile phone.
Because mobile phone is so much cheaper.
It's very cheap, yeah. Let's talk about, for a couple of minutes, about pensions and health and education and water and those crucial things, the building blocks of development, and how microfinance has a role to play there.
What we have done in India is to reach out to this 1.2 million peer families through 15 partners spread across 200 districts of India, that is one-third of India. The footprint is very huge. So this is now acting as a platform. The government of India has got a very beautiful pension scheme social security for the poor, but it never gets access because it doesn't connect with the grassroots. So our microfinance institutions are, we really worked, the Avikas opportunity, we really work with the government departments, and we forge those links between microfinance institutions and the government departments. So now the microfinance institutions are collecting the pensions of the poor people. And it's being run by the government of India. So they are, for the first time, they're getting access to pensions. We are now designing a community health facilitators program. Leaders from this microfinance in groups who are interested in that, we are training them in preventive health. For example, 1.2 million children die in India with diarrhea, a preventable disease. So we are training this community health facilitators to reach out preventive health, maternity health, and we are also giving them a livelihood, health livelihood, so that it is sustainable in the long run. They will also try and make those water sanitation loans and help people to have their own sanitation facilities. So it's going to be a huge development thing that is emerging and evolving. All of us are very thrilled and excited about it, and that's a hope in that dark scenario. That's a hope that many things will emerge out of this platform.
Great. All right. Thank you, Ranjini.
Thank you.
Thank you, both Ranji and Robert. I'm going to open it up for questions, obviously. I think it's very hard. I've only visited India once many years ago, but it's very hard for us living here to understand how very different a country it is. The scale of India itself is overwhelming. What we would see as the poverty is overwhelming, and to try and grasp what the microfinance is being able to deliver as a very large number of people, what a tiny amounts of money for us could hardly be a day's income for us, and yet it seems to have been so important. Now I'm sure there's lots of questions. When you ask it, if you could identify yourself, and either of you can decide who will answer, I guess. Down the back.
Yeah, if I just ask a series of questions.
Just identify yourself, please.
Okay, Ben Piper. First of all, give us an idea of what sort of interest you charge in India.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to know whether it's set locally or each country has different interest rates.
Yeah.
And how do you go in Muslim areas with interest?
The interest rate is basically a function of two factors, cost of funds and the operational cost. In India, the operational cost to run a microfinance institution, to go and collect weekly, monthly, to give, you know, to cater to that last mile, it takes about 12% operational cost. And then you just, it's a simply just add what is the cost of funds. In India, it is currently 13-14%, the bank loans. So the maximum rate, but Reserve Bank of India has capped it at 26%. But then if they don't have access to this, the other available resource, cheapest available, is 60%.
60.
Yeah, 5% per month.
From the loan sharks.
From the loan sharks. And then they don't collect in small amounts. They have to repay the full amount, and it never gets repaid, and it's a vicious circle. The other resources, commercial banks, they are mandated to lend at 12%, but this women will never get that kind of the KYC, the know your customer code, the track record, accessibility. All that is so difficult. That's why even after so many years of independence, we still have 60% of our population out of the banking circle. So for us, it's a question of access. And if things improve in the future, and if they go out and get a loan or a savings account from a bank, that's the ideal situation.
So just to continue on in that, in India, if you have one of these, a Visa card or a MasterCard, that's 41% at the moment from a bank if you have a gold Visa card. India's inflation rate is very high. India's interest rates are very high. The bank to bank overnight lending rate, you know, we think of 4.25% or something like that. It's around 14% in India. So everything's very high.
Yeah.
Gentleman down the back.
Jeffrey Baird, carrying on from the previous question,
if you have a loan over 50 weeks and it's a $100 loan, that would assume a weekly repayment of about $3 a week, I would think.
Yeah.
And if you're collecting that loan via like a receivable officer, what would be your overheads and what proportion of your operating costs would be involved in your receivable costs?
The operating cost, as I've already mentioned, is around 13 to 14%, and what we charge, it's an effective rate of interest that I've been talking about, 26 to 28%, but it's a flat one single amount that is that's paid off every week. Yeah,
and the larger the organisation. So some of those 15 partners are startups in areas where no one was serving people because it was too hard to operate. The back blocks are nowhere, and so when you're small, then you have to charge. Then your operating costs are going to be high. When you're larger, your operating costs come down. So in our largest partners, it's as low as about 9%. Yeah. Is the operating costs of the loan. Mm-hmm. But it is very intensive. What's interesting, what we see is very interesting, is these things are starting to make a difference. So banking by a mobile phone,
it's beginning to happen.
Yeah, it's beginning to happen. And not only that, that's the trick to getting a savings account, which is much more important than getting a loan. Because if you have a health disaster or any sort of disaster, you really want to have savings you can dip into rather than have to take an emergency loan.
So if you have a direct debit, it's going to be far better than having a collection office.
Correct.
On your doorstep.
Absolutely. You just need an agency network to make it happen, though. You need somewhere where you can go to get money out. We go to the wall, right, and get money out of a machine. That doesn't happen. So you need the equivalent of that. That could be a pharmacist or something. So all that's changing now. That will change the cost of the delivery of microfinance.
Hopefully, yeah.
And bring the interest rates down.
I have basically two questions. The first is, what percentage now of the financial loans in India would be being provided by this microfinance compared with the rest of the banking system? And also, India now has some very successful Indian multinational companies with some very rich owners, shareholders. Are these families that are, you know, a lot of them are living in Europe,
yeah,
are they supporting,
yeah,
these sort of projects? Because, you know, I was about to say, is the Gates Foundation, right? And then I thought, now there's Indian.
Yeah, sure.
Indian.
Yeah, so I can answer that. One is the out of the total bank credit, 1% is gone to the microfinance sector.
1%.
Yeah, in terms of absolute volume, it is about $5 to $6 billion dollars, but it is reaching out 18 million unique client base, but it's 30 million borrower accounts, so counting multiple loans.
And it could be, what, 100 million borrowers?
No, 30 million.
Yeah, but
18 million is unique,
yeah,
and borrower accounts are about 30 million.
But it could go up to...
It could go up, because we have reached only 10% of the total market. So it could go up 10 times.
Yeah.
Your answer to your second question, all our industrial houses are very interested in philanthropy, but they do it through... Citadas will have Tata Foundation, the Infosys will have their own foundation, so they'll all have their own foundation, they do it through that. And they're in the beginning stages of philanthropy, so it's education, health, you know, those aspects. Microfinance in India, unfortunately, because of these incidents, it's not seen as philanthropy. It's seen as more in the commercial space, and the media has also significantly contributed to that image build-up. So I think it will take some more time. And as the world moves from philanthropy to impact investment, that's a trend that is happening across the world, I believe that our people will come back to the table.
It's interesting, Zara's question about the creation of wealth in India. I was reading recently when I was in England that... the largest industrial employer in England, in Britain, is Tata Industries, yeah, the Indian company.
And
I mean, that's apropos,
yeah,
nothing to do with,
yeah,
this.
Well,
but
and Jaguar, don't they?
Yeah.
And Jaguar.
But
British, do you want to be?
Sure. Yeah. And Tatas are known for their philanthropy. They do a whole range of philanthropy.
Yeah. I, and as an Aussie, my heroes in this whole thing are Indians. I mean, it's the leadership of 15 partners we work with who basically just committed their lives to this. They come from all manner of different backgrounds, and we work with some incredibly generous Indians as well. in terms of funding. So it's a good story.
Is it Susan? Yes. Susan, isn't it?
Yeah. Susan Watson, a member of the Institute. Can you explain how do you give the new skills, the woman who learned to sign her name? Does that happen in the groups, or how do the people?
Yeah. So the loan officers actually go out to the village and they go meet up the village leaders and say, we are here and we want to start this program. And usually they make a noise and everybody turns up in a village. You know, when somebody new, something new happens, everybody turns up in the village and in the slums. And then these guys have a matrix. They'll just try to rank you in terms of your income and wealth, whatever little wealth they have. And then whoever is better off, they are not recruited into the program. Only the poor people have access, and mostly the women, if they are illiterate, these loan officers sit with them and train them. Like, this is how your name looks like, and how you, they just allow them to practice and practice. It takes about 3 days for them to really sign off.
Stephen down the back.
I'm Stephen Durek from the Institute. In microfinance working countries such as the United States and Australia, let's say, as efficiently as in India, and if so, how does it compare?
Poverty is relative, isn't it? So I've heard that Mohammed Yunus Grameen Bank is now starting up in US in certain areas, and yesterday we heard from Good Shepherd, it's a microfinance institution in Australia, that they give individual loans, not group loans, and they give loans for not for income generation activities, but for buying washing machines or something that will help the woman to improve her quality of life. Maybe Rob could add.
Yeah, there's a number of different ways. Opportunity spun out an indigenous-focused microfinance organisation called Many Rivers, but it's really business mentoring, because their issue is not that they're... Unlike the clients Ranjini sees all the time, their issue is simply that they have no money. They live in usually quite functional families, functional communities. They have just no cash. In Indigenous Australia, that's usually not the issue. They have money, but what they don't have is the dignity of being off welfare. So it's quite a different thing. It's about mentoring businesses, and that's very expensive, but very rewarding as well. We can talk in terms of millions of clients. They talk in terms of hundreds of clients.
Yes. Yeah.
Malcolm McDonald, what percentage of the loans would go to men, and how do men in a patriarchal society respond to an organisation or a system that is so dominated by women?
Yeah, 98% of our clients are women, and usually they are the ones who men are usually fine. I mean, they go in search of labor and work, and it's not regular work, but whenever they can get in different parts of India, and women are there at home, so they start up something. And usually we've seen many instances where the men come back and join the family. Even in Madhu's case, I showed, that was a classic example of how men join the program, and then it becomes a family affair. So I see that families getting united, migrant workers coming back. And I dream of a time when, you know, villagers don't have to leave their homes to go and live in slums of Delhi or Bombay. It's that's impact. And everybody loves to have most of the people would love to have a second income in the family when you're poor. And so when the income starts coming in, maybe initially they would be a little skeptic, but once income starts rolling in, people are happy.
The back first.
Yes. It's Shani Sharan. I'm just interested in the legislation that you talked about.
Yeah.
What are the protective mechanisms that have been introduced?
Yeah.
And can I sneak in a second question?
Yeah.
The second question is, there's been a lot of criticism about this group law,
sure,
tonight, and the kind of peer pressure that you put on in a small village.
Yeah.
How does that work if somebody really, you know, there's a major crisis, they default, can't repay over three or four months, or say there is a cyclone.
Sure.
So
first response, the legislation is highly protective of the clients. So whatever Reserve Bank has already stipulated, it is becoming a law. So no interest rate to be charged above 26%, no loans above 50,000, that's about $1,000. And repayment has to be at least 1 year, and if the loan is above certain amount, it has to be up at least 2 years, so there's no pressure on repayment. And the women are not allowed, the microfinance institutions are not allowed to give not more than two microfinance institutions are allowed to lend to one woman.
Okay, is it just a legislation or is there a framework?
It's becoming a legislation, and there is going to be a regulatory body. Reserve Bank can nominate either NABARD or one of the institutions to oversee the regulation. And also they're creating a microfinance council consisting of experts who will then oversee it and make changes wherever required. It's a progressive legislation and we are all happy with it if it comes through. Second aspect is, we said 97 to 98% is the repayment rate, so there is always a 2% loss. Of course, there is criticism in the paper and the media, and it may be a reality that there's been some coercive collection practices, but we ensure that our partners, we are represented on the boards of all our partners, and in the board we insist that they write off those loans. If it is genuine, they will make a genuine attempts to recover. But if there has been a cyclone or there's been a flood or something, and if they they get rescheduled in the first place, and even then, if they're not able to repay, we write off those loans. Yeah.
I think I should add to one of the girls.
Well, I was going to ask a question first,
which is, you talked about India. How does all this compare with Bangladesh, the Brahmin Muhammad Yunus microfinance in Bangladesh? Is to say the interest rate and the size and the philosophy.
I think Rob is a better person.
No, you haven't been to Bangladesh.
I was always so... Yeah. India's problems are so huge, so I've always focused on India and I've never done that kind of comparative studies. But I do understand that the interest rates are comparable. Methodology is hybrid. Indians have this habit of making everything hybrid. We see something and then we adapt it to our situation. So it's a hybrid methodology. It's group, but it's not group. It is individual, but it's not individual. Yeah, that is Shamini's one question. From third loan onwards, the group mechanism starts becoming frayed at the end, so then they move on to individual loans. So we are trialing individual loan methodology there. And in terms of there is BRAC and Grameen Bank. BRAC is more into the microfinance, what we call complementary services. So we earlier in India, the all focus was on do the microfinance, be make it a bankable proposition, and just focus on getting the efficiency right. So we have huge efficiencies coming up, but now we realize that there is an inherent risk in that, and so complementary services is coming back into the sector. So it's a huge, interesting, evolving story.
I'm going to ask
just what the size was in Bangladesh. The size
is about their size. It's million. How many millions? But India is not rich. It's about 50 million something. I have to recheck the figure. But Indian microfinance all put together may have reached that size, but no single institution has not reached Grameen Bank size. Yeah. Our biggest was 6 million outreach by SKS who went for the IPO.
I was going to ask, I believe the girls from Lauriston are doing economics or developing the economics. Is that correct? Economics? I'm hoping that you will have
a question.
Questions and see how this relates to what you are studying. Maybe you'd like to ask a question or indeed just make a statement about how do you feel what you've heard tonight relates to... Yes. What's your name?
Sarah. I was just wondering that at the beginning when you were first introducing your program, if women borrowers were hesitant at the start because of social and family pressures to borrow money, and if since then the numbers have increased.
Did everybody hear that? Yeah. Okay. Good.
Were there hesitancy because of social factors
There is hesitancy, but once they start borrowing and they realize that there is growth and it's good for the family, then they all become emboldened. And there you can really sense that empowerment happening. You know, the first loan lady may not even look up at the loan officer. She will have the sari pulled over her face. And by the time she comes to the fifth position, she'll be arguing with the loan officer.
And I often ask the men who... So all these women are in a room, strangers, especially people looking like me, turn up and go and meet with them. The men are not far away, or those who are around, they come close. I then go and chat with them. What do you think of this? and almost invariably we love it. It's more money into the family. Often, sometimes you'll get, we love it, my wife, I like it, my wife's status in the community has changed. And sometimes you get the opposite.
Very rare.
But it's pretty rare.
Right. Yeah. We'll wait till Anthony. Would you have the question?
Yes, and Lucy, sorry. Is there any criteria for who you lend money to, or and how is that regulated?
Yeah, there is a criteria. We choose only women, mostly women, who belong to very poor families. So how do you decide whether they are poor or not? So there is a whole lot of questionnaire and index. So you ask them, they won't know what's your, if you ask them whether you're poor or not. So you just go through those questions. Do you have a, how is it, or they look at the house. Do you have a proper house? Mostly if they have a proper house, they're not poor. So they'll have tin sheds for a roof. They don't, the total income, whether her husband is employed, is it a regular employment, is she literate, does she have cooking utensils, do they use, if they use gas or electricity, naturally they're not poor. So you, they will be using wood or some local resources for cooking purposes. So these are, and whether there is an, so these are all questions that they ask and they rank them. And those who are scoring very low on all these factors, they are chosen to be beneficiaries or members of this program.
Just harking back to the comments that Robert made a moment ago about the men. I should introduce myself. Sorry, Anthony. Mm-hmm. I've lectured microfinance at university.
Oh, good.
I'm an advisor to an NGO doing microfinance. I'm very much in favour of microfinance.
Okay.
But as you said, that's correct.
However.
Obviously, we're talking still about a 2 or 3% failure rate. Those failures. One of the things in the literature, in a lot of the literature, is talking about the level of domestic violence going up amongst microfinance recipients, both the failures being punished by family members, but also the successes sometimes provoking gender tension within family relationships. What's your experience of that, and how have you dealt with that?
Okay, so some of our partners' experience in that is to align themselves with domestic violence interveners or NGOs that specialise in that area. So one of the great things about development is you don't have to do everything.
Yeah.
So we know about the microfinance piece. We're not particularly good at the health piece, but we know some people who are brilliant at the health piece. And in Chennai, if you visit our large partner there, microfinance partner there, they work closely with an organisation that specialises in domestic violence education and intervention, as well as an organisation called International Justice Mission, which does rescue through police intervention of slavery. So these sort of things are real, particularly as you get close to borders. Anything to do with then the issues around sexual slavery in particular increase and become more real. So that's just a fact of life. We don't specialise in those areas. What I've seen personally, you don't tend to see it. When you turn up, everyone's behaving well and shiny and it's all pretty good. When you talk to our partners about what actually goes on, there are areas where because of cultural difference, men's response is more difficult. It's predictable. You can tell where those areas are likely to be, so you can then do stuff about it. But it is challenging, and every development program should, no development program should be presented as a really beautiful, you know, here are all these shows. I mean, we do that. We like to show hope. We're not into showing despair. But you should know that it's difficult and it's messy and it doesn't always work. In the Philippines, there are more men in the partnership, in the programs there that we're involved with. And the way that plays out is men often take individual loans and they'll take higher ticket loans to do agriculture. And the women take loans where they still work in groups, even if it's an individual loan, they'll still meet in groups because there's good social equity in that, even though they're not guaranteeing each other, they still like to do that. And so I've been to places where this side of the room will be full of guys and this side of the room will be full of their wives. And these guys have agricultural loans and these ladies have group loans or what we typically call microfinance loans. So it's just, there's a whole genre of gender issue. It's a real live issue. It's not easy, but you can tell where it's likely to be a problem.
Jim, can I just say, someone did ask a question about the Muslim usury, and I don't think that was actually answered.
Good. Islamic microfinance.
In India? It's not very prevalent in India, and our microfinance institutions lend to Muslim women, especially in Lucknow, Hyderabad. They have been participating in this, and I think in India it's more relaxed. So the Muslim that level of microfinance is not very prevalent. Yeah.
In Bangladesh.
Oh, microfinance is an Islamic finance product. So it's about fees, not interest. And like all good Islamic finance, you can get to the same end point by calling things differently and calculating them differently. So that's how it works.
Is it John?
Yeah, it's John Morrison, Girls School. So I'm going to ask a question on behalf of the girls. They haven't yet studied development economics and microfinance.
Okay.
That's the end of the course of this. They're going through macro and microeconomics. But one of the textbook criticisms of microfinance is this issue of commercial moneylenders accessing the social moneylender market. And it's really quite a major problem. So I'm trying to understand how they can ever be managed in a way that stops this overcapitalization, oversupply for a market that really hasn't developed it to the level that the supplier wants it to be.
Are you talking about people taking microfinance loans from social microfinance players and then heading out the back of the shed and then becoming loan sharks with the money? Yeah.
Or the loan sharks. Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. It happens, but
So the question is, how do we try and minimise that in the future? Because the textbooks. And the girls are
going
to have to write.
Yeah.
Possibly write.
Yeah, yeah. So get those pencils ready. Yeah. You want to go? You go. Do you want to? I think the onus is on organisations like Opportunity and Dear Vicus to fill that gap. If our loans are at 15% less than a credit card rate, and the alternative is 15% more than a credit card rate, we better be there, and we better be with flexible products. Where loan sharks get the jump is when there's an off-cycle event. So Ranjini has explained, they turn up, they make a big noise, everyone comes to the meeting and they work out who's poor and who wants to play, and then there's about 3 days of training, and those who want to go on with it and meet those responsibilities stay. And that's how it all starts. If that's all you do, and 12 months later issue new loans, then I'm sorry, but health disasters, any sort of disasters, don't fit with that timetable. So what you see is people need emergency loans. Some people can pay off their loans quickly and need to go to the next loan. This one-size-fits-all, mono-product, micro-credit play is not client-friendly. Our partners are part of that in places like India. Up to now. So one of the great things that's come out of this crisis that's occurred through Andhra Pradesh government clamping down on microfinance and everyone having to go, how are we going to make this sustainable at 26%, you know, our costs are more than that, blah, 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 is that you have to be sharper and have to be smarter and have to have products that are actually going to suit people's needs. There's my answer to that is social performance management is the discipline that helps you get to the right answers. Now, everyone knows how financial management works. It's a whole set of procedures and processes and reporting on whether you've made money. And it's great for your objective on making a financial, on meeting your financial objectives and showing people you have. Well, if your organisation's all about social objectives, you need to have the same thing. You need to have processes, procedures, and reporting on whether you met your social objectives. And that's what social performance management does. Ranji talked about the survey. The survey we use is from Grameen. It's the Progress Out of Poverty Index. It's something you can longitudinally, you can test whether your client base is poor. You can test whether the products through focus groups, whether the products you give them are meeting their needs. And you better have some smart products like emergency loans, early repayments, flexible products, so that when the disaster comes, they don't go to the loan shark. And really let the market rule. Let the market outdo the loan sharks, and woe on us if we can't do that. That's pretty much it.
And in one of the impact study, the earlier impact studies, it was found that wherever the microfinance operations are going on well, the loan sharks have reduced their interest rate.
Now,
yeah.
You've had a go.
Oh, okay, I'll be last.
All right, you may have to. You may come to you.
My name is Emma.
Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, my name go ahead. I've got two questions. The first one would be, so like the women who take out loans and stuff, where do they like to invest the money most? So like, would they rather spend it on like getting like their essential needs, like food and water, or would they rather spend it on like education for their children, or like trying to get health insurance and stuff like that? And then the second one would be, if like a family was like really impoverished and stuff like that, would the microfinance sector ever be willing to give out a loan to both the man and the woman?
Good questions. Very thought-provoking questions. The loan that the woman takes, it is always deployed to, in mostly it's deployed for income generation purposes, and she will use the income from that small business to bring, you know, buy food or get the children to school. That's a choice that the family would make. But the loan is, there are exceptions where in seriously indebted communities, the first loan would go to release them from that loan shark. There are product designs to address that. And the second question is whether the man would get a loan. There are example, one of our partners, Shikhar in Delhi, they call it a family loan. So the husband is always involved in the documentation purpose, in the documentation, and they prefer the husband being involved with the wife. So it's not like microfinance is against men or they don't want to give to men, but usually their skill sets are very different, and they would like to engage in a higher level of economic activity which will require a higher capital, and microfinance is not designed to provide larger ticket loan sizes.
Now, one more question, I think, before you have to hand up there, so.
My name's Steve Cook. I'm just wondering if you've kind of already reflected on this difficulty in accessing the commercial sector, the commercial loans with a lower interest rate, and you've answered this a little bit. I was wondering if you reflected a bit more on what's happening, what activity or lack of activity is happening to get people access to those services. I'm thinking particularly because if there is a a survey that happens to see whether or not people can access a loan from Opportunity International, and if they're successful in that loan and then they also may have electricity in their home or something like that, which means that they are no longer they're now too wealthy to receive another loan to continue climbing up that income ladder, but still can't access commercial loans, what options are there?
We find that 10% of the client population would move on to, are more entrepreneurial and would like to go on for improving their businesses, go on to create bigger businesses. And commercial banks, especially the development banks in India, are now coming out with a product to meet that segment. But all said and done, the commercial or the formal banking is more costly. And and in India, the regulatory system and the political system won't allow you to charge formally 26% or 36% by the commercial banks when they're lending to the big players at the same rates. So it's a very complex political, legal issue, regulatory issue that is at play, and it's very difficult to get a breakthrough with that. But what the Reserve Bank, Central Bank of India is now doing is they're permitting commercial banks to appoint banking correspondents. That is, the MFIs can become their agents, and the bankers can then download their products to the community through this channel, including mobile banking. happening. So these are the interesting things happening in that space, and I hope the central bank is really pushing reforms in that area, and their main theme now is financial inclusion. So we believe that the sector will open up in the coming days. Yeah.
Thank you. I'll now call on Vice President Lawrence Reid to respond.
Aside the presentations, and by the way, I love the duet process. I thought that was fantastic. I thought also the Q&A session has been delightful this evening, very energetic, and thank you very much for all of you who have asked questions. Just by coincidence, I was actually reading today in Foreign Policy magazine about the recent World Bank report on poverty eradication and the pace at which that's proceeding around the world. It came out with its most recent figures just a week ago, and it's headlined or subtitled the amazing gains in poverty eradication that are occurring around the world. The number of people that are being lifted out of absolute poverty, the World Bank threshold of $2 a day income or less, and the accelerating pace at which hundreds of millions of people are moving on from desperate straits to having at least a less marginal existence is exhilarating reading. The level at which people are developing to is still by no means, by obviously our standards, anything worth feeling good about, but nonetheless the basic gains that are materialising they're carrying is quite dramatic, and the recent World Bank figures are quite digestible and interesting, I think, to read. So I'd like to thank very much our speakers tonight, not only for their presentation but more substantively for the role that they and their organisation has played in the process of eradicating poverty. So our thanks to you on both counts for both your presentation this evening and for the work you're doing. Thank you. And I'd also like to thank the young one we have here this evening from Lauriston, former president and current national vice president Zara Kimpton is a former, again, a student at Lauriston. So if Zara can be our former president and current national vice president, I hope that one or more of you one day will also be of a similar stature in this organisation or take on other similar roles in other civic institutions across Australia. I'd also like to just briefly refer to you to our forthcoming events beyond tonight's event. We've started 2012 with some really strong events across an extraordinarily diverse range of topics, and coming up next week we have a session on what's happening in Italy, from crisis to salvation. Can Mario Monti, who's the newly appointed but not elected Prime Minister of Italy, can he save Italy? And that's a presentation by Professor Pasquale Scro from Deakin University. The following week we have another very topical issue, which is on the edge of a nuclear crisis. Dr. Emmanuel Ottolenghi from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies from Washington I think what's happening with Iran has got a remarkable sense of inevitability about what will occur, and so his speech to us in a couple of weeks' time will be, I'm sure, very pertinent. And the week after that, these are all, by the way, on Thursday evenings, all at the same time as this evening, we have a presentation from Richard Tanter from the Nautilus Institute for Security and Sustainability on After Obama, back to the Joint Defense Facilities, and that's in light of the recent joint announcement of the posting of Marines to the Northern Territory. So thank you very much, everyone, for coming this evening. It's been a great event. I really enjoyed the interaction in particular, and particularly to our two presenters this evening. Thank you very much for coming along. So.